And welcome to another episode of the Airgun Geeks podcast, where today we're talking about the LCS SK19 semi-auto in 25. Today we have special guests Robert Buchanan, one of the owners of Airguns of Arizona and Precision Airguns Distribution. We have Steve Shally from AEAC, and we also have Bill from Target Forge, also my co-host for tonight. How y'all doing?
We're doing well. Thank Good. You for having me. I appreciate it.
No
too.
Problem.
Happy to be here.
Awesome. This is, I'm so excited. I don't even know what to say. All right. First off, how's everyone's doing? Good. That's good to see. Robert, I know you've been traveling all over the country. Did you get your leg stretched and all that?
Yeah, well, you know, lately I've been going around helping to set up a series of Grand Prix events for Extreme Field Target, EFT.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of been, you know, where my destinations have been. You know, we've been to Texas with Ron. I haven't been to Oregon, but I've got my main man on the road with the van, Larry Piercy. He's been there to support that match real well. Here in Phoenix, at the Phoenix Rod and Gun, we do a Grand Prix event there by Ben Spencer, kind of sets up, and that's his domain. So that's been a lot of my work. We've got another one going on here fairly soon. Let's see, Ron's and the Tech Stream is going on, I think, next weekend. Not this weekend, of course, but the weekend after. And then we've got one going on up in Utah with David Stevenson as the match director there. I think that's in August. So that's been a lot of our work is getting that started to kind of promote the EBR EFT as the culmination of those Grand Prix events. And we'll have a Grand Prix for the year winner, EFT champion, and also a EBR EFT champion. So they may be the same person, they may not. Just depends on, you know, if they've traveled and earned points with their with how well they shot and attendance of the event. So I'm really excited about that. That's a lot of fun. I think a lot of people are kind of enthused that that's going on. And, you know, that's kind of where I've been, along with a lot of product testing. There's a lot of new products that are right around the corner for us. You know, I've talked to Steve here recently, and so we've got some bombs to release over the next 3 and 4 months in the industry. So, you know, I've been working very hard at proofing those and helping the pre-production, you know, prototype work and all of those things that we're pretty jacked up about.
That's exciting.
So,
yeah, a lot of people don't realize behind the scenes, you know, you look at a company like Airguns of Arizona, Precision Airgun Distribution, how much of their efforting actually shapes the final product, whether it's a day state, a Brocock, an LCS Air Arms, or whatever it else is that, you know, they've got their hand in, you know, the the production of. And yeah. It's always been a fascination to me learning that, how hard you guys work every day to evolve those products to what they are before the public gets them.
Well, I think the public thinks we just buy a gun and sell it.
You don't?
Right.
Oh, learn something new right now.
You know, those days are long gone. You know, it was a little bit more that way years ago, whenever we were first into the industry. But if you want to be successful, and if you want to have enough, you know, to be honest, profits to be able to support and run a company and grow a company, and to support and grow products and make new products, you know, those things don't come out of thin air. You know, it takes a lot of hard work. And we've become much, much closer to our manufacturers in terms of trying to make sure that the products that we carry benefit the marketplace and appeal to the marketplace.
Yeah.
And we're always striving to be the absolute best. People say, you know, competition is a great thing, and it is. You know, it keeps you moving. Mm-hmm. My idea is to make the competition really squirm. So that's what we try and do, is, you know, always bring to market things that are very, very desirable, very fair in terms of cost. You know, value for money is very important. You know, you've got folks like Steve here that's a, you know, integral part of, you know, bringing those things to market and showing them off. Bill, the same thing. You know, he's got a line of his targets that that he's trying to constantly improve and to make better and to make more unique and interesting. You know, you don't get to sit down and sleep much, really.
No,
that's just the way.
No, it's we have very specific needs here in the U.S. And one thing I learned is that, you know, like a precision air gun distribution, their manufacturing partners, you know, overseas, they may not know our needs. And so it's, you know, it's companies like Air Guns of Arizona that kind of relay that from the ground level so that ultimately the manufacturers can build a product that the customer says yes to, like this SK-19 semi-automatic, which is launching 34 grain pellets at 55 to 65 foot-pounds of energy, 19 in a mag as fast as you want them. You know, it made an incredible pesting gun.
It's just a lot of fun. You know, people like to have fun when they shoot too. You know, we're we're always looking at trying to make the most accurate, most powerful gun that we can, you know, that appeals to people with the right weight and all the rest. But the LCS is very unique in that it's very accurate, as I think you've found. And it's got fantastic power, but it's just so much fun too. You know, just to go out and shoot, it's kind of like an adult version of a BB gun, you know, really. It's you know, shooting 10 cans at 100 yards as fast as you can pull the trigger as opposed to shooting 10 cans at 10 yards. You know, that's the kind of way that I and it's a serious gun too. I don't mean to take that away from it, but it's a lot of fun.
So my question, Robert, you know, because I've heard of LCS Air Arms, and everyone gets them confused with Air Arms. It's like, no. So researching this and knowing your standards, where do these come from, and why did you choose to put your name behind it to be a retailer for it?
With us initially.
Okay.
The product is LCS is out of North Carolina.
Okay.
They assemble component parts. They're an assembly plant, really. They assemble component parts that they receive. Those component parts, some are made in Asia, some are made in Germany, some are made in Korea and other places. So they bring those in, much like other manufacturers. Most manufacturers today, and I don't want to name names because I don't know if they'd want me to, you know, bring in component parts and assemble the guns and test. And that's how they do it to keep the cost reasonable. If the LCS was 100% made in the U.S., nobody could or would afford it. It would be, I think, a $4,000 or $5,000 air rifle.
It reminds me a lot of how the auto manufacturers do it, where you read the window sticker now, where it'll say like foreign parts content, you know, X amount here, X amount there, but assembled in the United States. It kind of reminds me a lot of how the auto industry does it, how this brand does it.
We're in a global market, you know. That's why the pandemic has been so brutal to the world economies, because, you know, we sell stuff to company A that's in, you know, country B, and they sell stuff to us, you know, and everything gets shut down, you know, or slowed down. So LCS came, the representatives of LCS came to us, I don't know, three years ago now, maybe four, I can't remember exactly. And they contacted one of the gentlemen that used to work for me, who actually is one of the promoters of Element Optics, that, you know, your shirt that you've got on there. His name was Shane Keller. He had a pretty decent relationship with the people that, you know, they called, and he was the first point of contact. And they set up an appointment to come to show the product off at our store, which they did very, very early on. And of course, you know, I'm always very skeptical, really. You know, my first response is, you know, here's another air gun, great. Something else to have to stock and put on the shelf and spend money on, you know. But it was very impressive, and most of the guys really thought it was, like I said, it was fun. A lot of the air guns are fun, but this was like a full automatic gun that shoots this kind of power and this kind of accuracy, and I don't need a license. That's a big deal. So a select fire, you know, semi and full. And then Steve, you just did the semi-auto. I want to make sure we clarify that.
Yeah, and to kind of piggyback off Robert a little bit, LCS approached me shortly after they approached Robert, and they wanted me to be a part of what they were doing. And I wasn't, you know, full disclosure, I wasn't really comfortable at the time because I have mixed feelings about the fully automatic piece component, you know, when it comes to air guns. But when they developed the semi-automatic version, you know, I thought to myself, now that's something that I really felt a strong need to share with my audience, because at that point it becomes a very useful, purposeful tool, mm-hmm. you know, for hunting or pesting. You know, I don't think a lot of people are going to spend, what was it, Robert, about $2,300? Is that what they cost?
Yeah, what is it, 22? Depends on 30 cal. The 30 cal is a little bit more money than the 22 and the 25 calibers. I don't remember exact, but that's close enough.
Yeah, around there. So when I saw all those elements come together with the regulator, which is, you know, externally adjustable, a hammer spring, which is an externally adjustable, a Lothar Walther polygonal barrel, you know, all combined with that semi-automatic and a 19-round magazine and a hammerless valve system, I said, you know what? That's really interesting. I think air gunners will really appreciate that. And I kind of was like, hey, you know, you still feel like doing something on AEAC.
It was time for you to get on. It was time for you to make a presentation.
Yeah. And so I'm kind of in the middle of that now. So if you guys have, for those of you that are watching on YouTube or listening on the Air Gun Geeks podcast, on YouTube's AEAC Home, the Air Gun Exploration and Advancement channel, you'll see a full review coming on this gun, as well as a really good time hunting iguanas down in the Fort Myers, Miami area, which I just came off of a 3-day hunt. I don't want to call it a hunt. It's more of an invasive species eradication event, I think is probably what it really is.
The green call.
I can't wait.
It looks like you had a good time.
They were thick. Sometimes it was like as fast as you could pull the trigger. At times.
Wow.
That's crazy.
But anyway, to kind of get back and kind of bring home your first question about LCS. So they came to us. We showed a limited interest. The gun wasn't really ready yet. Then we, whenever it became closer to being, you know, kind of in full production, we would always been their first point of contact. They chose us to be the company that sold the gun. And, you know, we were happy to do that. There's some roads that we could take that I don't think we need to take, you know, about how and all it came to pass and all the rest. And if people want to, you know, find out that information, they can always ask me personally. But, at the end of the day, they came to us. We were happy to invest the time and the money. It was a big expenditure in cash. Because you have to buy these things in advance and pay for them in advance to get them coming. It's not like they send them to you and then you write a check for the invoice. That's not how it is. So it's been a big investment for the company to make it happen, but it's paid dividends. We have a lot of happy customers. They're so unique and so much fun. I don't know if I can say most, because I really don't know the exact numbers. The guys could tell you a little bit with better clarity and accuracy. But a lot of the LCS guns sold are the first time people buying an air gun, because they're not interested in buying a gun that goes clickety click, you know, and the precision that we love as air gunners, you know, bringing a sight lever back and hearing the thing click into place and then moving the bolt forward and concentrating on a target and pulling the trigger, that doesn't necessarily appeal to a lot of firearm shooters. You know, they get that itch scratched with their powder burners, okay? But this is like, wow, I now have an itch that I didn't know I had, and it's having something like that I can shoot a full mag in no time.
It is very... coming, you know, being a guy that shoots powder burners, AKs, ARs, shotguns, sidearms, you know, being ex-law enforcement, the SK-19 is a very familiar shoot, to Robert's point. And it actually has a firing cycle that feels a lot like my AKs. You know, how the AK...
Made that mention of that.
Does that mean really slow?
Yeah. Well, it's almost, you know, you shoot an AK and you can feel that 1 pound, you know, reciprocating mass. It's almost like a locomotive. It's like clack, 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 clack. And it has that really unique feel to it.
Like a Sten gun almost, or Stein gun or whatever. I don't know how to, you know, I don't know the proper pronunciation of it, but you can, you know, there's definitely a mechanism.
Yeah, for me, it's a very definitive, like, clack, clack, each time you shoot it. And it's a very satisfactory, fulfilling, tactile experience. And it was just very familiar, to Robert's point, which I can see why the powder burner guys would like it. You know, you don't cock anything ever. You just fill it with air and you fill the magazine and you turn off the safeties and you start shooting. And
we had the one of the representatives of probably the largest archery company in the United States. And I won't mention the name because, like I said, I didn't get permission to mention the name. And I wouldn't know if the owner would or wouldn't mind. So, one of his sales reps came into the store and never bought an air gun before. He was driving by one day, the store, and he said, "Air gun, I'm going to check that out." So he pulled in and he, you know, kind of was in, you know, wonderland of all the different products. And he ended up, first air gun was an LCS, called the owner of the company. And I think they bought 2 or 3 or 4 of them at the end of the day, you know. So
that was a good day.
Yeah. We have a lot of good days like that. Mm-hmm. But it just appeals to a real wide range of customers because how unique it is.
It's got.
I think the airsoft guys are going to like it too. Mm-hmm. It has that airsoft gun feel as well.
Well, but that out of that sport. Yeah, kind of cheap. Airsoft to me means cheap, you know, and it's not cheap. It's not cheap to buy and it's not cheaply made. So when I hear airsoft, I always go to Think Toy in Walmart.
No, I wasn't applying that at all. It just has that firing cycle that's very reminiscent of that. I mean, it's a 9 pound, 14 ounce deal scoped and with a silencer on it, filled with air and lead. So it's no airsoft gun.
Have you ever fired one, Bill? Or
I have not, and I knew of the automatic one first, and I was like, because I have a varmint business called Varmint Guru, and that's why I bought a Leshy. It's a quick follow-up when walking around the ponds and whatnot, and then when I heard Steve was reviewing the semi-auto, I'm like, and that's why I'm excited for the video to come out, because, you know, I want to go hunt iguanas, and, you know, I'm chasing muskrats and rabbits and all types of stuff, and quick follow-up shots is... it's simplistic versus running around with, you know, any type of side cocker or whatever. Cause now I'm left-handed, so I'm generally okay, but I'm excited.
Yeah. Robert, I got to see one, when I was at PAE with you, the Pacific Air Gun Expo. Mm. You were up there with the LCS crew, and, I got to see it there for the first time. I've not shot it, and one day I would like to. But I think what I'm curious about is what, you know, these are obviously complex devices. I mean, there's a lot of parts in there. A lot of things have to happen at just the right time. What type of warranty do they offer on those guns? And is that service done by your exceptionally talented team at Air Guns of Arizona, or do they go back?
It is. No, we service the guns and we do all the warranty repair for 3 years.
No.
Now that does not include, you know, if a guy jams a barrel full because he wasn't paying attention, you know, it doesn't cover abuse or neglect, you know, but for the operation and the rifle working as it's supposed to, then that's a 3-year stint for the gun.
It's a good warranty in the air gun industry.
Very.
Yeah, it is. It
says a lot.
It is. And I can tell you, the company is, I'm very proud of our service department. It's a massive part of the company. I don't think most people understand how effective you have to be and organized to import guns and to do the warranty repair and service and stock the parts and, you know, and be a good partner for the manufacturer. You know, the manufacturer is looking for a good partner, and it's difficult to do, you know, but I think we do a spectacular job. I can't say enough for the guys in the service department. It's a full-time job for what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 guys I think we have. You know, they're constantly, you know, taking care of customers' needs. And if there's a warranty issue, great. If it's a service issue or a tune, you know, I, one of the things I don't think people, maybe the industry doesn't understand is we do massive amounts of air gun tuning. You know, we don't advertise that we are tuners, so to speak. You know, a lot of guys, that's how they make their living, is to advertise and talk about that they, you know, send me your gun and I'll tune it for you. But, you know, my guys are equal to or superior to any of them, you know, and a lot of the time they're giving advice to the guys that are advertised tuners. We've got enough work as it is, but they're very, very good, and they know what they're doing. And we have outside folks that also help us. You know, the Daystate brand, we have, which I know this is not the topic of this conversation, but we have a whole team that is dedicated to improving the product and doing the things necessary to put it at the top of the competitive line.
Yeah,
I can certainly echo your sentiments there, Robert. I have experienced your sales, not your sales, your support organization, and I have nothing but praise for them. And I thank you for their assistance and for you actually helping me get them engaged. It was really helpful.
Thank you. You know, you're welcome, and I, you know, appreciate it. Those kind words, you know, it means a lot. The repair staff, you're only as good as your repair staff. You know, if you sell X amount of guns, let's just pick a number for a number, right? Say you sell 100 guns per month of a particular brand. You're going to have, you know, they're PCPs. They leak. I don't care if it's a $5 PCP or a $5,000 PCP. It will.
You're preaching to the choir.
Yeah, it just will. You know, they're very high tech. There's a lot of sealing surfaces, so the chance of an O-ring or something getting nicked on assembly, it just happens. No one likes it. No one wants it, but it happens. So, you know, if you sell 100 of a particular model, you're going to have it anywhere from a 4% to 10% rate of failure or issues. Okay, so, you know, that could be 4 to 10 guns per month of that one model of gun. Okay, that one model of gun, and then you do that the next month, that's another 4 to 10, and the next month after that, that's another 4 to 10. So unless you are prepared to see 20 to 30 boxes a day come back to your facility for issues, you know, you might want to think twice about getting into the air gun industry, because, you know, that's part of the price you pay. Absolutely. And what you expect is to
back it up. Oh, sorry. Sorry, no, go ahead, Bill, I interrupt. But Bill, I wanted to kind of touch on what you were asking about the warranty. You know, as a YouTuber, as a reviewer for the industry, it's not my job to break stuff, but I definitely like to try to push the limits of the product to see, you know, how much I can get away with. Mm-hmm. And I will say in with the SK-19 being a semi-automatic and being a 55 to 65 foot-pound deal, maybe even more, I was very curious to see, you know, how well it would run, you know, before I had a malfunction or before, to Robert's point, loaded up the barrel with 3 or 4 pellets, you know, at the same time. And before I even took it down to Miami to go hunting with it, I had over 1,000 rounds in it, not only tuning it, but also testing all the JSB variants, all the H&N Barracuda variants, the ZAN slugs, the JSB slugs, the H&N slugs, the FX hybrid slugs. You know, I wanted to see in all different weights, I wanted to see if there was anything I could do to trip up that hammerless valve mechanism, semi-automatic mechanism in the gun. And I'm happy to report I haven't had a single failure.
Wow.
Prior to the hunting trip, on the hunting trip, at which we took a lot of iguanas. It's like 28 or 30 the first day and another 25 the second day. And I had my fair share of misses in there. We were out in 101 degree heat. Oof. And I just, the thing just would not mess up.
Most of the issues that we see with that gun are owner caused, for lack of a better term. You know, they turn the regulator up. People are always searching and playing and doing what they want to do. And the factory says I can get X amount of power. I bet I can get more. You know, so they crank the regulator up way beyond where it was designed to operate, or they crank the hammer, we call it a throttle, at the bottom there. They crank the throttle up.
It's almost like a water spigot is the best way I could describe tuning
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it is. Pretty much, yeah. Good observation. But they, they try and ask the gun to do what it wasn't designed to do.
Sure.
Or they just want to see what the limit is for fun. And then, when the regulator said it may be 200 bar and they only have 210 bar in the gun, it's not going to run. You're not going to get any shots. You're not going to get any performance. So, those are the things that we see. We do get issues occasionally with it, but it's generally almost always owner caused or user inflicted,
I believe that. I actually went, I don't know, Bill and Patrick, if you guys, I know you've got questions prepared for the audience on the SK-19. We've probably barely scratched the surface of that, but if you have tuning questions, I have familiarized myself with the gun. I actually detuned it for my needs because I wasn't getting accuracy that I wanted. But ultimately, I got pretty close, and I feel like if I had detuned it even further, then, there was how I received it, there's how the owner's manual recommended it be set up, and and then there's kind of where I went with it or wanted to go with it. I'm prepared to answer your questions or walk the audience through that as well, because I feel like I've learned what it is that gun wants to be a real laser beam.
Yeah, and everyone's a little different, just like all the other brands, right?
Yep, yeah, for sure. It's definitely the barrel lottery. It's got a Lothar Walther polygonal in it. That barrel should like the JSB 34 grain variants, and it did.
Mm-hmm. But probably the Mark 1's better than the Mark 2's, I bet you.
I actually had better luck without the Mark 1's, which is funny because that just speaks to the barrel lottery.
Yeah.
They get like the regular JSB 34 grain best, but I it came out of... I don't want to get into this unless you guys wanted to actually ask about it, but came out of the box shooting a 9.36 average. So with that pellet, so I was getting some instability.
Mm-hmm.
I wound up, once I got the speed from the 9.36 average that it came out of the box to the 900 average, that the owner's 903 average that the owner's manual recommended, most of that corkscrewing went away. And I feel like if I had either backed that off even further, maybe to 885 or maybe a 915, I could have completely eliminated it, and made a really good 50-yard gun, 100-yard gun. But
and you can adjust the reg pressure and things. You probably didn't have the time nor the desire, maybe even to go that deep into it. But you could have probably played around with that.
I did quite a bit, and I can share all those findings with you guys later on if you want, if you have questions on tuning. But I also tuned the heck out of it with the 0 dB moderator. There's a segment I did on Instagram where I had 3 or 4 different 0 dBs, and I set the gun up to shoot at 50 yards, and I went through each of the 0 dB moderators, and instead of like a harmonic barrel tuner, I actually tuned the frequency of the gun to where I got it shooting like 3/8 inch groups at 50 yards with the 0 dB moderator. So I actually wound up using that as a tuning tool to further hone the tune that I had put on the gun. And I had quite a few hours. I had like 2 full days in tuning it, because it doesn't tune like any other air gun you've ever tuned before. You've got a regulator pressure setting, and then you've got, I think what Robert, we were calling like a spigot, or Robert had another word for it, but
the throttle.
The throttle, it's like a throttle. It feels like you're controlling like an aperture, and it does have an influence on what the valve does, where you can feel it like loading up the valve to make it work to kind of get the results you want. tightening up those ESs and SDs. It was an interesting learning experience for sure. And I have all my settings if you guys want them later in the program, if you wind up going down that path.
Well,
that's a great resource.
We're going to quiz you, Steve. We're going to definitely put that on the test.
I think Steve got all my questions. I'm like, yes, tuning great. Yes, I've seen where Chris from Up North Air Gunner has tone tuned, like you were doing with the zero dBs, and how that affected things. Like, that's a very high pitch. This is a lower pitch kind of sound, and what are you looking for, and all of that. So yeah, I mean, tuning is a big part of the questions that I had, because it seems to be very easy to tune. Is it toolless?
It was easy from the standpoint that the regulator and I want to keep calling it a hammer spring, but it's not. The two adjustments on it are both externally accessible.
Okay.
Very, very, and they're both knobs to turn.
Oh, so no tools.
No, it's toolless. 100%.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Okay.
Well, there's actually like a the regulator adjustments on the front over the bottle, and it's on the outside, and it has like a little hole in the side of the knob where I was sticking like a pin to turn it, and it's click.
Okay.
It's a toolless deal, but it just behaves nothing like. But
that's cool that it
like can, a regular tune. It took like 2 days to figure it out.
Yeah, I've been staring at your Instagram. And the fact, and that was going to be one of my questions, is does it click or was it smooth? Because clicking, you can count and then go back to where you were originally at, and
yeah,
so forth
and
so on.
Oh. Yeah, I had a notepad where I was, you know, I recorded where I was originally. It has a manometer and a pressure gauge where you can see where you're at on the reg. The owner's manual suggests a regulator area and some of these other things, and it tells you where you want to be on velocity with a 25 grain and a 34 grain. Which I tuned the gun to that, because this wasn't per se an AEAC tuning guide video. Mm-hmm. You know, that wasn't asked of me on this one, but I wanted to have a successful hunt. I didn't want to drive 4.5 hours down to Miami and be missing iguanas at 50 yards. And it's a good thing I did, because one of the things that I learned that I didn't know about harvesting iguanas is you get within 55 or 60 yards of them and they're off. You know, it's not like, you know, if you go to Jessica's YouTube channel, Iguana Solutions, it's not like, you know, she's shooting all her iguanas 20 feet up in trees. Like, she'll tree them, and then she'll get in there with her Brocock Atomic and plunk, 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 and they're falling down like giant avocados, you know, out of the trees. Yeah. It wasn't that. Like, I wanted to capture really good scope cam video for the audience. So we were like, you know, bipod, back of the truck. You know, sneaking up on these iguanas out in the grass, just, you know, eating away. And
you were more hunting iguanas than eliminating iguanas in a way, weren't you? I mean, you shot a lot, but
Shot a lot. Yeah, Robert, to Robert's point, it was difficult because you get with this. That was like the magic number, like 50 yards. You broke that like red line, tripping a laser beam. They were like, and they'd start looking at you, and their little dewlaps would start going, and they'd start like this, and one of them took off, the whole herd would take off. So we had either two options. They were really an interesting species where if you downed one in the cluster, like if you got lucky, a headshot, and just boom, toppled them right over, and he just lay, the rest would just stick around. And you could just plump, 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 plump. That was a really cool component of being able to, you know,
it's film good
information. With the SK-19. It was like playing a video game almost. But if you tag that first one and he was like, boom, and he went and ran off, the other ones would run off after him. So it was a very difficult type of deal because, you know, they're reptiles too. You can get a heart and lung shot at 50 yards with a 55, 60-foot-pound gun, and they're going to run. They're going to zombie up on you and boom, and they're going to be gone. And the rest of them. So you're trying to hit like this half-inch target.
By the size of a dime,
right at the base of the skull to light them out. So that the rest of them will just kind of sit there and you can kind of pick. It was very challenging, very fun.
It's funny that you say that, Steve, because Ted of Ted's Holdover talked about the order that you shoot certain birds.
Starlings.
In their life cycle mattered to whether or not you're going to get a follow-up shot.
Interesting.
And of course, from an animal behavior standpoint, both of these creatures come from the same origin. the iguana and birds are you know, they share a lot of similarity. They both came from the same point in time.
The dinosaurs.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
My wife has a huge flock of chickens here. We call them baby dinosaurs because they act like you would expect a dinosaur to act. But yeah, it's interesting that you said that, and you kicked another rock loose in this broken mind of mine. And, you said that you were messing with the regulator. Is that regulator, adjustable positive and negative with air on it?
No. Well, it works kind of like how you would expect like a Huma to work or like a previous generation, FX regulator, you know, that kind of thing. Where you can increase pressure to your heart's delight, but if you want to decrease pressure, you unscrew the bottle, and then you dry fire the gun 1 to 2 times. You don't want to over dry fire it because you don't want that hammer going when there's not an air cushion in there. But if you just dry fire it 1 or 2 times, it'll dump all its air out of its reservoir, and then you can back that.
So you're just bringing that pressure that's in front of the regulator down a little bit, so that you can come back up again and adjust upward. You're trying to always adjust.
Yeah, I brought it down a lot of bit. I mean, I ran with it. You know, it was up around 145 bar when I got it. Mm-hmm. I wasn't happy with the ES. I think the ES was 36 feet per second. And I had like an 8 SD shooting that 930 something average with that 34 grain. I wanted to try to shrink that because I knew that was going to be important trying to reach out 50 or 60 yards.
Mm-hmm.
On these things, and I was able to do that by running a lower regulator pressure. I had success at 130 to like 131 and 138 were the two reg pressures I wound up making shot charts at. And the spigot that Robert makes reference to, the external adjuster on the valve, I actually slowly opened that. I wound up 7 clicks more open than OEM, and what that seemed to do is put pressure. It kind of like loaded up that valve where I was able to shrink those ESs and SDs down to like a 25 ES and like a 6 SD over like 55, 60 shots at 55 foot pounds, which even for what we were doing was way, way overpowered. Like I didn't know the circumstances in which we were going to be harvesting. And when Jessica's like, yeah, you know, we're going to this big public park in Broward County. You know, the county's like commissioned us to save the burrowing owls in the park, and you know, the iguanas are there digging up their burrows and displacing their nests.
She got free labor out of you, basically.
Well, she did because she was getting paid. I won't disclose the amount, but the contract was like per iguana, and we took like 60 of them in 48 hours.
Nice,
and we didn't even put a dent in it, man. That place is just infested. But you're out there shooting with like, you know, basically a 22 rimfire, you know. Power level of an air gun, and here comes some mama jogging around the corner pushing her baby stroller, and you're like, oh my god, what am I even doing out here? Or you'll shoot and you'll hear a ricochet and you're like, oh my god. So if I ever go back to there, I'm gonna want like a 20 foot pound 22 deal, maybe 16-18 grain max.
Well, that's why she's running with the Atomic.
That was the perfect gun for what she does, because like I said, they chase most of them up trees and just plug them all in the trees, but that doesn't make for good Hollywood.
No.
You know, for YouTube, I wanted to get out so we could see that pellet travel, muzzle to temple, you know, sort of thing. But it was kind of a good thing we did, because it's like I said, they wouldn't let you get within 55 yards of them, you know, until they'd start moving on. And when they start moving, man, they're either to the tree or to the bushes or to the water or whatever.
How much do they weigh, a big one, Steve?
15 pounds. Most of what we shot were probably between, I would say 3 and 8 pounds. We had one where I got this all on film. Jessica took off like a Steve Irwin, man. Like we had the GoPro and she was plugging like this little one out of a palm tree above our heads. And I kid you not, this 5 footer, like 11, 12 pounds, comes launching out of a palm tree. Does like a Peter Pan. It's like, boom, and it goes, good. And this thing hits the ground, and I'm there with the GoPro, like, Jessica's like, oh. And so Jessica, like, puts down her gun. This iguana takes off like a, you know how they run on their back legs?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a frilled lizard, a Jesus Christ lizard.
Head up and just starts hauling ass on his back legs. Tail is like a wheelie. You know, and it's just, and then Jessica's like, boom, she goes, does a Steve Irwin, takes off after this thing. And I'm like, I don't even know what's happening right now, you know? And she chases this thing like 50, 60 yards up into another palm tree. She goes shooting up into the palm tree, and I'm like, what is even going on right now? This thing hasn't even been shot. And I had read, like, online beforehand, you know, they have teeth like razor sharp, mm-hmm. and they'll whip your eye out with their tail, and their spines are like razor blades. She goes up this tree after this thing. She grabs it by the tail. And she's holding on the tail. She's going, help me, help me. And I'm like, what do you mean help you? What do you want me to do? I'm just the camera guy from Tampa. You know, I ain't touching that thing. It's alive, you know, tail going. So long story short, I reached up there. I got the back leg. She's got the tail. You know, I got one hand on the little GoPro. And we're like yanking this thing out of this tree. And long story short, she fell out of the tree. I fell out of the tree. The 12-pound iguana fell out of the tree alive. And she's sitting on the ground just hugging this thing. And I'm like, you know, at the end, I'm like, why in the world would you go through all that trouble? And apparently one of her friends, she does. She's insane for this iguana.
Yeah.
She's got tons of footage of this kind of thing on her YouTube channel, Iguana Solutions. She's on Instagram too. She has two Instagrams, Iguana mm-hmm. Solutions. And I think Iguana Sniper, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, you can get your fill of this girl, but she's amazing. But she wanted this iguana to feed like one of her neighbors or something.
She feeds.
So she like taped it all up with electrical tape. And
so did she say
it? The behind the back.
Did she say it, Steve, when she got it?
She say what?
Got you iguana?
Oh, she said that. So I was trying to film, you know, for Air Guns of Arizona and LCS. And every time I would, you know, vaporize one of these things, you know, Jessica, to her credit, I wouldn't have been able to do this without her. I wasn't prepared. This is like, I'm not, you know, I'm a review guy. I'm not like a hunter YouTuber. So it was like this huge learning curve. And, but she was great. She kind of held like the other camera. I was working the scope cam. And but every time I would vaporize one of these things, she'd be on the other camera and she'd go, got you, iguana. And I had like 10 clips with this got you, iguana. And we had to have like a little powwow. I'm like, you know, we can't say that in every single one of them. The audience is going to think we're weird, you know. So we eventually worked through that.
She doesn't care.
No, she was great. She was super accommodating. She really got like in the mindset of helping me produce this video that was outside of what, you know, she would normally produce. And man, she was amazing. Amazing.
She can shoot that little Brocock too.
Oh yeah.
She could. Well, she was headshotting everything.
Well, my nickname for her is Miss Annie Oakley. Every time I talk about her, I go, you know, Jessica from Iguana Solutions, you know, Miss Annie Oakley. There it is. Gotcha. And she's still talking to you. And I'm like, how do you do that? You know? So yeah.
She's very passionate about what she does. She's really into conservation and, mm-hmm. and trying to eradicate, you know, the iguana from South Florida. It's a real problem down there. And yeah. I was really not even tuned into it because here in Tampa Bay,
you guys just don't have Tampa.
200 miles north, we got nothing. It's really? Too cold here. Too cold here. Yeah. Our winters get too cold. And but man, down there, they poop like a 20-pound dog. There's poop, you know, the poop like a Canada goose.
Mm-hmm.
Same. All over the water slides in this park, all over the pool deck, all over the boat docks, all over the boat ramp, all over the walkways and the running pathways. And, you know, and like I said, they were displacing the native species of the Florida burrowing owl, which I also have some really good footage of that we'll put in the video. And then the residents of South Florida have real issues with them because they poop all on the pool decks and in the swimming
pools. It'll kill your pool real quick. One poop, done.
Big time. Dude, they're huge poops, and they eat all the vegetation. Yeah. So the condo associations, the churches, the schools, like these are all the types of places that are contracting, you know, hotels, like marinas, like these are all the places where she's down there eradicating, you know,
she's
the species.
Got a lot of work, doesn't she?
It was endless. Like
it'll
she
never
could
end.
Barely find two half days to spend with me. Her phone was going like crazy. Like, I'll be there tomorrow. Sorry, I'm late. And it was just insane. Like she was taking calls like like hourly throughout our time together.
I watched a Zoom call where it was the Florida State Wildlife. They had the sheriff and everyone, and they said they're expecting about 50 million iguanas by 2025. It's
amazing.
It's
they breed like
well, they used to breed like pushing out the date. Yeah, they used to breed once a year. Now they're doing it 2 to 3 times. So, and then you got the green iguana you're going after. You got the Mexican spiny tail, and now there's a hybrid. And now there's African Nile monitors in the canals, and you have the tagu.
Yep.
We won't even talk about the anacondas that they found down there now. So that's a whole nother thing.
It's an interesting thing. And, you know, AEAC, you know, this is this kind of partnership with Robert on this hunting deal where I'm going to try to merge review and hunting together. This is a new direction for me. And I'm going to try to do it with every gun that I touch, because it's just such a relevant thing to life in Florida. And it seems to be really meaningful to air gunners, too. And the SK-19 was just such a great product to be able to kick that off with.
I bet.
Because like I said, you're bing, bing, bing. I had several like twofers and double taps. And, you know, and the reptiles, they're not birds. They can hold their breath.
Matter in a situation like that, you know? I mean, a semi-auto has its place to where nothing else can come close.
Yeah. And they hold their breath for 45 minutes underwater. So it's like I said, you can heart lung them and they'll run 100 yards, no problem.
Yeah.
And take all their little buddies with them. So there was a lot of pressure to, you know, with those headshots. And so I was really glad I moderator tuned it, because at 50 yards, it changed a 3/4 inch group to 3/8. So
unless you're potential a freak of nature like Tom Adams on that bolt.
What's that?
Unless you're a freak of nature like Tom Adams on that bolt, your follow-up shot, you're not going to get it unless you've got a semi-automatic. Mm-hmm.
It was very, very useful. I didn't know what to expect, and it was just very useful in that environment. I really came to appreciate, you know, it's a heavier deal. It's 9 pounds, 14 ounces, something like that. Scoped, you put a bipod on there, you know, you're 11 pounds, 11 and a half pounds ish. So it was a truck bed bipod type of venture. I wouldn't want to be freewheeling it too much, but it just worked really, really well for that situation.
So
before we get back to the LCS gun, I just want to ask one more question. And Steve, you're a lot closer to this, and Patrick, you are probably closer to this as well. Do the people in wildlife control really believe that eradication is possible, or are we just trying to control? Because I know, like here in California where I'm at, I wage an enormous war against rats, and you're never going to win. And people who think, well, I'm just going to get rid of all the rats. No, you're not. Mm-mm. Because there's a whole cluster of them over there. There's another cluster over there, and they're going to keep coming. You can control them. You can definitely reduce their numbers, but eradication, we did that to the buffalo, but shooting a buffalo is a heck of a lot easier than an iguana that's hiding in the woods or a rat that's in the ground, you know?
If I use the word eradication, I probably didn't pick the best word.
Mm-hmm.
I do feel in my heart of hearts that there's no way that anyone's even going to put a dent in this. I think most of what it's about is you have, it's like I said, you have a preschool, you have a church,
right?
You know, you have a condo association, and it's just like any other pet. You know, whether it's a pest, whether it's a termite, you know, whether it's a rat, whether it's whatever, bats in your belfry. I think that these are just legitimate people with legitimate challenges, and call on these companies to just try to help. And I think anything they do is a very temporary solution, but it fills a niche and it answers a need. And
do they have a natural predator?
No. So that's the problem. And
maybe like a hawk, maybe.
So the gators will eat them, but you know, overall, it's more to answer Bill's question. It's a control thing. So they're trying to control what's going on. You spray for bugs around your house. Well, once a month or twice a month, once you get it, the population dwindled in that area, it's just a preventive thing. It's never going to go away. They have too many.
Like, you're not going to get rid of the mosquito.
No. No, you
ain't happening.
In other words, you would you shoot to keep it clean. As far as predators, we're primarily their predator. Alligators eat them. Crocodiles eat them. Hawks, not so much. Vultures, if they're dead. But most of the time, no. Because they, and we only, if you watch, you can find the Zoom call with the state of Florida. We're not even seeing all of them. They live underground. So you have
the
aquifers.
They live in burrows up in the trees.
Well, mm-hmm. You got all the aquifers and underwater water in Florida, and they're saying they're traveling underground.
Wow. They do. They run through like the not irrigation, but like the conduits
mm-hmm.
that handle like the water draining, and then in the canals and anywhere they can find a hole. Like in that park, yeah. It was the Florida burrowing owl. Those are their main two places. They live as high up in the tree as they can get, or deep in the ground as they can get. And then they have these cycles where they come out and they're like cattle. They eat grass.
Yes, they'll eat anything. They're even turning. They're omnivores now because they eat eggs. They'll eat some meat things. They'll eat primarily, vegetation. But that's
snails,
just the green iguana.
Snails.
We're just talking about the green iguana. You still have the Mexican spiny tail, which is mm-hmm. highly aggressive, and will bite. They actually look like little dinosaurs. But yeah, we could have a whole podcast on iguanas. But
yeah, we need to.
So
got to focus on.
So to go back to this,
tuning in for this.
So
I apologize.
No, you're good. You're good.
Question, Bill.
Well, because it shows a purpose for the gun, and why. And personally, looking at hammerless, short of my knowledge was the early LCS auto. Then you got the Blitz, and then the new Edgun Leshy 2 came out, and then now this is out. And it's always been gimmicky and not necessarily trustworthy. Is it going to function? Kind of thing. But that seems
The hammerless systems are more trustworthy than the other semi-automatic systems that we've had, the experiences with.
And I agree. I agree.
Unless, I couldn't break it.
Unless you build a semi-auto to an extreme level of precision and durability, and that costs a lot of money, like a recoiling system,
mm-hmm.
This kind of thing. It costs money to do that in a way that that is robust, We've just not had to date good success with any other semi-auto other than the LCS. And, we do sell the Leshy. I don't have a lot of experience with Leshy. We sell them. They seem to be good. So, that system is maybe a lot like the LCS. I don't understand it as much. So, but the LCS has been really,
mm-hmm.
kind of head and shoulders above.
Robert, how does it compare to the Hooban?
Yeah. Oh, you
it's
beat me to it.
To the Hooban. Yeah. It's very similar. The Hooban is my understanding. We used to sell Hooban years ago, but the Hooban wasn't nearly as consistent for us. Other people have other experiences, so I don't want to step on any toes. Mm-hmm. But the Hooban was more difficult to keep running. And a lot of that was because of the relationships with the factory and getting component parts and communication and all those things that kind of speed up being able to service a product.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that.
Yeah. So I can't speak to it now, but our the LCS has been much, much better, and the relationship with the factory is much better, and they're much more attentive to our immediate needs to make sure we get people's guns up and running, whenever we need parts, O-ring seals, this kind of thing.
So here's a question for you, Steve. Maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
What's the maintenance like? Is it hard? I saw some pictures on Instagram, your Instagram. How hard is it to like clean the barrel, lube it up, make sure you do your proper stuff?
So I'm going to do a quick barrel cleaning video on this gun.
Okay.
Because there's a, it's very easy to answer your question for two reasons. The first reason is the Lothar Walther polygonals, they tend not to hold lead
mm-hmm.
unless you're like stupid with them, push them to like 930 feet per second, 950, whatever, the lead just doesn't stick in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people, when they get their polygonals in that 880, 890 range, they never clean them. ever. You know, I know the RAWs, the Rapid Air Weapons or Rapid Air Works now, whichever it is, you know, that's kind of like how they'd like to tune those guns. So from that standpoint, if you tune the gun in a good place, it's next to nothing. But to answer your question very directly, you know, there's no bolt to open to pull like a cleaning patch through or whatever. So what you have to do is there's just two screws in the breech that you loosen, and then you unscrew the shroud, which just slides off, and you just unscrew the barrel counterclockwise, and it threads right out. And then you've got this barrel, and you can just clean it any way you want to. It's a very quick and easy thing. The key is when you put it back together and you thread the barrel back in, you thread it in until it lightly seats, and then you back it out about a 10th turn. And then you lock those two bolts on the side of the breech,
which
hold it in its place, and screw the shroud back on. And the reason that is that floating valve system, it has to seal with the barrel, you know, because the pellet or slug's actually being launched through the magazine into the barrel and out the muzzle. And there's two floating apparatuses. One, the magazine itself actually floats forward and backward and seals up against the back of the barrel. And then on the backside of the valve, there's a floating, like kind of a copper washer that floats as well too. And then when that all gets pressurized with each shot, they kind of, whoop, they seal on their two ends.
Yeah.
That seals the magazine. And, you know, away goes your lead. So that indexing of, you know, screwing in the barrel till it lightly touches, back it out a 10th turn, lock everything down, test fire the gun, dry fire it, make sure that your magazine is rotating through that dry firing, and then you're good to go. If you don't have the barrel backed in enough screwed in enough, then, you know, those sealing mechanisms may not be able to do their job. Your ES and SD might not be what you want it to be. And if you have it backed in too tight, the magazine's not going to be able to rotate and auto index like it does. So you go about a 10th turnout from seated, and I had really good results there. I had 21 ES and a 6 SD at 61 foot-pounds by 50 shots. I don't know how well you can see this. Let me put it right where my face is.
There you go. That's very level. Wow, look at that.
It just kind of there it is. Ow. Yeah, you know, for that kind of gun, for what it is, you know, to Robert's point, it's not meant to be a precision instrument. You know, I didn't even fiddle with it at 100 yards, and I wouldn't unless this was a tuning guide and I can bring the velocity down 880, you know, something like that. But at 50,
they will shoot at 100. They'll shoot inch and a quarter if tuned properly with the right pellet match.
I think I could get it there. It would just be a matter of getting the velocity right. You know, for me, you know, for someone that wasn't able to moderate or tune, me putting the best tune on the gun, it was about a 3/4 inch 50 yard gun, like 4 or 5 times over. And I sampled that. I'm going to show all the groups in the video. And then when I moderator tuned it, I got two groups at that same tune at 3/8 at 50. And so I feel like if I was able to take that even a step further and retune down to 880-ish, 890, because what I was seeing was 1 in 5, 2 in 6, I'd get that instability pellet, where otherwise they're traveling nice and smooth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure you could get it there, but that's just not what, you know. Can't have a 45-hour video. Something's got to give.
Man, now I got to make room in the closet so the wife don't find out that I got another gun. Yeah, because it's like for what I'm doing, and a big thing on the podcast is, what's your purpose? You know, what are you doing with that? And me pesting, don't get me wrong, I'm an FX guy, but I'm a product. I need it to do a specific job and a quick follow-up, because I don't want anything to suffer. I want a quick, fast dispatch. And then move on. Especially if you're eating the animal, you don't want to destroy the meat, you know.
Right.
And I'm very interested in this now. I'm like, So you definitely got my eye.
It's a neat deal. I think it can get there. I just, you know, for the audience, I wouldn't want them to get this and have such huge expectations, because I don't think it was Robert can, like, you know, correct me if I'm wrong. But I don't think that the value proposition of the SK-19 semi-automatic or fully automatic / semi-automatic is to shoot MOA at 100 yards. I think out of the, I feel like out of the box for most people, it's going to be a 3/4 inch 50 yard gun. And then if they take the time to tune it, then moderator tune it, you know, you can get that down to 3/8 inch and then probably, you know, get your 1 inch, 1.5 inch at 100 yards.
Well, it's a rifle that appeals to 95% of the reasons why people buy an air rifle.
Mm-hmm.
We represent, you know, it's in your name, Airgun Geek, right?
Mm-hmm.
We represent, you know, the geeks and the nerds and the dweebs of airgunning. You know, we're really splitting hairs. But most buyers, that's not who they are. You know, they want to buy a rifle that they can shoot in their backyard, take camping with them, take it on a hunting trip. You know, maybe when they go deer hunting, take it as a camp gun. You know, these kinds of things, you know, they buy it for general use to replace their rimfire that they can't shoot in the city limits, but they can shoot this in the city limits in most cases. And it's equal, if not even better, a better tool to do that job. So, you know, it would be counterproductive to try and, you know, make it what it's not, you know,
because yes.
What it is 95% of what everybody wants anyway. So you'd be trying to gain 5% and lose something on the other side. So
that's a great way to word that, how he said, like, I was trying to make it what it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I took it so far to get me to where I knew I could put on a good show for you guys on the hunt. But to Robert's point, that would be trying to make it kind of what it isn't.
But it's not intended. You don't buy a pickup truck to go run races on Saturday night.
Right.
You know? And you don't buy a sports car to haul groceries. So
you got it.
Very good way to put that.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah.
So I got to ask Steve.
Yeah.
Does it shoot slugs? Because everyone's going to ask.
I couldn't get it to. I tried everything. I tried all the weights. I tried all the brands. So my guess is it's either the twist rate or the choke that's on that Lothar Walther polygonal, but I also, it might. I mean,
the gun will absolutely shoot slugs, but the barrels on those guns have not been designed to shoot slugs. Like Steve said, it's two screws, unscrew a barrel, screw another one in and good to go. You know, it's all about the barrel technology, the twist rate and the size slug that you're shooting and all the rest, you know. So I would say, yes, the gun is absolutely capable of shooting slugs. But maybe that the barrels that they're supplying, remember, it's in its 9 out of 10 form, it's a semi-stroke full auto. You know, pellets are generally a lot less expensive to shoot and more accurate at anything inside of 100 yards in most cases than slugs are anyway. So, but, you know, LCS is working on slug barrels so that if somebody can buy just a barrel after they already own the gun, screw the barrel in and go on their merry way shooting.
You went right to my question, Robert. I was just going to ask that very question. Was there a path going forward to get slugs in this thing? And apparently the answer to that is yes. That's
well, absolutely. The issue that all air gun manufacturers have is, you know, barrels. You know, you've got customer A that wants to shoot a light slug. Well, okay. And you've got customer B that wants to shoot something heavy and a different design. Well, you know, one barrel, one twist rate, one profile is not going to accomplish all things to all people. Well, the manufacturer can't order, you know, X amount of barrels to get a decent price. And then have all these different flavors of barrels and make sure that they're still a good quality, rigid, proper diameter barrel. You know, I mean, you want something that's going to hold up. You know, you don't want to go cheap on a barrel. You know, that's a lot of the heartbeat of the gun is the barrel, especially whenever you're talking semi-auto where there's more vibration. Harmonics are coming at the barrel very, very fast. The barrel doesn't
have time. Last thing that touches your pellet.
Yeah. The barrel doesn't have time to untune it, to unvibrate, you know, with a semi-auto or a full auto. So you've got to have the rigidity to be able to stand that. But Yes. The short answer is yes, it's being worked on. I think a lot of the manufacturers across the board are working on it, but it's a laborious process to do correctly. You know, don't just want to bring something and say it's a you know, this shoots slugs. Yeah, it might shoot one slug. Good. You know, but you know, that may be a slug that not everybody wants to shoot, or you can't get a decent supply of. You know, ammunition is an issue. Getting good ammunition is an issue. Getting enough good ammunition is the even more difficult issue that we deal with. And whenever you think you have a good ammunition, next time you order it, it's not good anymore. You know.
Unfortunately.
And you can't build you can't chase that, because you'll be it's something that will never stop. So either you have to make a good choice and then run with that choice, and hopefully that it satisfies everyone's needs most of the time, because you're never going to satisfy everyone all the time.
You've got jerks like me and Ted Beer out there that when we find a pellet that actually works in a particular gun, we go out and buy one or two sleeves of them at a time, you know, and we're definitely contributing to that scarcity that market space. But, you know, it's so, like you said, it's so important that even when you find a pellet that you like or a slug that you like, and you go to reorder it again 3 months later and now it's out of a different lot.
That's correct.
You don't quite get that same performance, and you're like, "Oh, I don't want to get burned by that again." So I'm going to buy everything you have, and then.
Well, we deal with this frustration on a daily basis. I can tell you, my repair staff that are doing custom tunes for a lot of the competition shooters. You know, there was a time where, and I'm not going to name names, but a specific 22 pellet that was heavy shot extremely well. And now they don't, you know. So people are trying to find what they had a year ago by, you know, maybe polishing their barrel or rebarreling their gun or going to, you know, all manner of gyrations to try and achieve what they had, whenever all they need to do is go find an old tin of pellets that they had and shoot it. And it's, you know, it goes from shooting at, you know, literally 3/4 inch at 50 yards to 1/4 inch at 50 yards, where it's almost like, well, this is simple to shoot. You know, I was really working at trying to get this thing to group, you know, with this tin of pellets, but with this tin of pellets, I can close my eyes and pull the trigger, you know, and that's just the world that we live in with, you know, with the limited manufacturers that we have, and, you know, those magical dies wear out, or, you know, manufacturer A complains that they need the pellet to have a little bit deeper skirt or thinner skirt, or enough people complain that maybe the pellets are getting damaged, so the manufacturer gets tired of hearing that the pellets are getting damaged, so they make the skirt thicker. One of the things shoots like hell because, you know, it changes the center pressure and it changes the dynamics of the pellet. Well, yeah, they got what they asked for. They have a pellet tin that doesn't, there's no damaged pellets, but now they don't shoot good. So, you know, in that, it's basically wash, rinse, and repeat. You know, that process just happens over and over again. So you buying two sleeves of pellets and an LCS will last you about an afternoon, though. You
know? I mean, yeah,
it does. And Bill and Patrick, I grabbed the manual here, and it does, to Robert's point, it looks like they've built this barrel around. It references the JSB 25 grain and the JSB 34 grain. So it's no surprise that it, you know, that performed well with that 34 grain.
Sure.
And the only other thing I wanted to add is I was able to get the gun to run with all those different slugs. You'd have to manually seat them a little bit deeper into the magazine, which is made of titanium, by the way, to get it to hold onto those slugs. But it ran them. So, you know.
You know why it's made out of titanium?
Yeah.
Why?
Oh, no, I didn't know why. Oh, yes, I have an idea, but I'm not going to try to guess.
Well, if you have an idea, what's your idea?
Inertia.
Inertia. Yeah, inertia.
That was a good one, Bill. I think Bill. I think Bill's right.
There's a reason I'm a geek.
Yeah, the timing to make this thing clockwork properly, and I think Bill's dead on. Well, I think it's an important deal.
Well, to have those two ceiling surfaces on each side, it has to be machined right and perfect. There's a lot going on there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, you need the mesh that needs to be light so that it'll spin with the least amount of air pressure, you know, to make it spin. Yeah. So, you know, that's an important feature.
You know, down this bunny trail, I just thought of something that I wanted to add for the audience is, you know, there's different terms for this, lock time, shot cycle, dwell time. It's slower on this gun. It's not too unsimilar to shooting like a Springer. So you really have to do your part. Like when I first got it, I was like, man, this thing sucks at 50 yards. But it wasn't that. It's that I hadn't learned.
It was Steve sucks at 50
yards. It was Steve sucks because it's a different type of deal, you know. Right. And
you got to follow through with the gun a little bit.
It's follow through. It's hold. It's grip. It's cheek pressure. You know, the trigger is, it's not a match grade trigger. It's a good two stage with a little bit of a rolling second snap, you know, and it's kind of a heavier deal too. So you really got to do your part. That it's like, to Robert's point, the inherent accuracy is there, but you're going to have to bring your A game as an air gunner if you want to try to make this into some sort of match gun at 50 and 100. For a hunter, it's going to be great. But if you try to push,
I find all bullpups, and I've been doing a lot of testing, a lot recently on different prototype guns and things, and I just find all bullpups to be much more difficult for me to shoot at a real high level than a rifle. I think it's something about maybe the center of the recoil of the gun and where that is and how much, you know, more movement there is depending on where that recoil center is. Whereas a barrel out in front of me, I can control that more. You know, I get more rearward pulse recoil than I do the gun turning on its own center, which a bullpup kind of does. So
yeah, I get what you're saying, that lateral grip and that pull down kind of grounding everything.
Your face and everything is in the middle of the barrel or close to the middle of the barrel, and all those pressures that you impart on the gun, whenever the gun goes off, you're going to torque the gun in a manner that you're not going to torque a rifle. So, and other people have other experiences. Other people, you know, shoot fantastic with them and they do better. But for me, for a competitive gun, you know, if I'm trying to shoot the best I possibly can, a rifle just seems to hang out there. The weight's out there in front, and it just moves a little bit. I can follow the pellet down to the target. You know, I can see the pellet fly and all the rest. So, you know, I just think bullpups, my opinion, bullpups in general, I don't care what brand, what make, what style, are a little bit more challenging to shoot to me.
With the SK in regards to torque, when you're firing it, every time I shot that gun, except for once, I had it on an AccuTac bipod and then set up on a bag on the back. And the gun itself is wonderfully rigid. Like the frame is really rigid. So I wasn't really feeling that. And that AccuTac was really planting it. So it's actually a great bench / prairie / bed, you know, truck bed type of, it's a really good gun for that. So if that's the type of shooting that you do, I think it's going to appeal to a lot of people.
Well, you get a lot of power in a short little package with it, for sure. And that's bullpups in general, anyway.
So I got to ask, is it okay for lefties? I'm a lefty shooter.
I don't think it matters other than the safety placement, which I hated, by the way.
I haven't heard any complaints by left-handed shooters.
Okay.
I don't think it would matter because there's nothing for you to manipulate, Patrick.
Okay.
Just move your earplug over from your right ear to your left ear, and you're good to go.
I don't.
Yeah, there's a lot of noise that comes out of that. There's not a whole lot that comes out of the business end. It's all kind of right here, and it's a tactile clack clack. You know, like right here. So you want to wear protection on that side. The moderator definitely quieted it. Does that 0 dB definitely took some bark out of it, but it wasn't like what I would experience with a normal 60-foot-pound air gun, where it's all up on the muzzle end. It's
all the mechanical.
It's
noise.
Almost like that mechanism. It's almost like it muffles it. It mutes the report quite a bit down at the muzzle end, but over here by the ear, you can hear that mechanism coming through your jawbone. Yeah,
it's good to
kind
know.
Like a stapler gun going off a little bit.
Like a what?
Like a stapler gun going off a little bit.
Yeah, stapler. I don't know. I've never experienced that, but
yeah.
I did.
So it
like
sounds like a staple gun a little bit.
Yeah, it's a clack. It reminds me of my AK, honestly. It's the same clack clack for me as my AKs. It just sounds exactly like it.
That's cool.
Yeah, good question. Yeah.
Yeah.
No way you guys are out of questions.
Well, you guys have handled, like, we went step to step to step. This has been, like, the easiest podcast. I'm like, oh, that's great. Yeah, keep check marks. Yeah. Is it pellet fussy? Nope, it's not. Yeah.
You've got two guys over here, Steve and myself, that like to hear ourselves talk, so... You know,
well, that's what makes a good podcast host. We throw some tiblets out there and you guys eat them all up and run with them. I'm like, God, he's going to eat all our questions.
Just run away like a freight train. That's how you know you've done a great job as a podcast host, guys, when your guests just get diarrhea of the mouth and can't stop.
I just throw a little piece of food over. But like the big things that I was concerned was, you know, semi-auto being reliable. Yes, that's come a long way. Warranty,
check.
3 years. That's that they check. Stand behind it.
Yep.
Dependability, size, weight. I mean, pellet fussy. It's really not. You just need to know what it likes, and they tell you. There's no guessing.
It is. I ran everything through this thing, all the 25. It likes. And it's
you,
a one.
You literally have everything.
I have most of everything, and this barrel was the. These guys at LCS or Robert, whoever was pulling the strings over there, they've designed this gun to shoot around the JSB 25 and 34 grain.
Yeah.
In 25 cal. I don't know about the 22, unless it says here. Let me see. Yeah. 22, 25, and 30. Everything here references the JSB pellets. So I got it shot kind of okay at 25 yards with the Barracuda Hunter Extremes.
Mm-hmm.
I was getting nicklers at 25, probably hold together at 30, 35, but all the Barracuda variants, the Barracuda itself, the Barracuda Hunter, didn't really, the Polymag it didn't care for, the Hornet it, by H&N it didn't care for, but man, it likes that JSB food.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, a lot of them do, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's got to do with the lead-in. You know, the lead-in of the barrel is designed and the... included angle of the lands and the rifling, you know, have been designed for that pellet. You know, I wonder if you've got a pellet like the, you know, like the Hornet that has a sharp, kind of a driving band as a head. You know, the lead end of the barrel's not been designed for that.
Yeah, because it's basically like
I'm trying to remember. I may have misspoke, Patrick. On the Hornet and the Polymag, I don't honestly remember. Go back to my Instagram, you'll see if I had it on the table and if it worked. But I know everything else fit in there.
Yeah, because it's a unique situation. It's a lot like the Leshy. It's leaving the clip, and then it's going into the barrel. It's not being pushed into the barrel like 9 out of 10 other air guns, and then having air behind it with a probe.
Big revolver.
It's It's a revolver situation, and that's very, very precise. And to be able to go without ripping the skirt off, which I've heard has happened in the past when they started doing this type of style, it would just rip the skirt off, and now you just got a head coming out, is remarkable. You know,
it is. The magazine was actually rifled. When you look into the that titanium magazine where it holds each pellet or slug, it's actually rifling in there that bites into the... Yeah,
oh,
you can see it.
Yeah.
And I would actually push a pellet in there and then go around the front side and push it back out with like a, you know, a little screwdriver or a pin tip or whatever to see what it looked like. And it's leaving marks on that. More marks, I would say, than what you would see a polygonal barrel leave on there. So I'm not sure about how all that tech works, but it was just an observation.
That's to make sure that the pellet stays in place when you load it. Gives you a little bit more friction on that pellet when you push it into the magazine.
You just reminded me of something I wanted to share with you, Robert, because you were talking about it earlier with the pellet manufacturing being what it is the last couple of years and dies and us dealing with all the craziness in the world right now. But that titanium magazine is so precisely made. It's almost like a pellet gauge. So I'd have like a tin of JSBs or the tin of the day states, which are made by JSB, mm-hmm. or a tin of the FXs, which are made by JSB, whoever it was. And you know when you've got a bad a small head size, because you'll push it in tight, 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 and then you'll get a pellet that wants to just like fall in and fall right out of it. And then it's so you can kind of cull your bad pellets with that. With that titanium mag.
That's a very expensive part of that gun. It is
very interesting.
Very well made. It reminds me of a turbocharger. I mean, in a way, you know, the vanes on a bearing and a turbocharger. It's everything has to be perfectly balanced. It's it's almost aircraft grade type of precision.
It felt like it. There was only one rule, if I remember, and that's don't shoot it below 150 bar, because you might not get the clocking out of it that you're supposed to. I didn't, and I didn't have any issues.
Well, you can, but you know, we try and make sure that we give ourselves a little bit of margin for error there, because you know, if you tell people don't shoot below 150, they're going to try 140, and then they're going to try 130, and then they're going to keep trying until it doesn't work anymore.
Oh, I broke it.
And air gun gauges suck too.
Why is it they're as an right. animal, we human beings always have to go find out where the edge of that envelope is? We're never happy with hearing the limit is right here. Well, if I go past that?
And air gunners, Bill, have that even worse than the typical human being.
It causes me so much grief. Drives me insane. I'll tell you a quick story. We had and this is not an outlier, this story. I had a gentleman that we sold a very high-end rifle to years ago. I think it was a Daystate CRX, I think. You know, back, 20 years ago, that was top level gun, and it still can compete at the highest level. You know, very, very well made. Great barrel, great trigger, massive trigger. The trigger's the size of a breech block of most air guns now. But so this gentleman got the gun, and he somehow got my cell phone number, and I don't know how. I have no idea. And he was in Hawaii, right? So you know, my phone rings at 2 a.m. and when my phone rings at 2 a.m, I'm thinking,
somebody
okay, the alarm's going off at the, or we've got somebody hurt, you know, my mom and my dad, you know, something's happened. You know, it's not a good thing when the phone rings at 2 a.m. And I pick it up and the guy said, "Hey, is this Robert?" I go, "Yeah, you know, I'm still waking up."
Wrong number.
This is, I won't repeat his name. This is such and such. And I go, "Oh, okay." And this is back whenever I used to do a lot of the tuning in my home. And I mean, this is in the early days. And he said, my gun doesn't work. What are you talking about? It's 2 a.m. Your gun doesn't work. He said, "Yeah, I just got the rifle and it doesn't work." I said, well, tell me what happened. He said, "Well, I got the gun and I took it apart to see how it works. Now I can't get it back together." I said, did you shoot the you took it apart?
We all do that.
Did you ever shoot? What happened when it was shooting? "Oh, I never shot it. I just got it and took it apart."
And we're all air gun detectives. We all do that, Robert.
What's wrong with people? Why can't they buy it, just use it, and have fun with it? Not everyone is an air gun technician.
But we all try to be.
Why?
I think that's the fun part of the fun of being an air gunner.
Why? You know, I don't claim to be a you know, a rocket engineer, or I'm not going to go and try and
build a block wall. I can neither confirm or deny. Never done that. Neither confirm.
We are all tinkerers. We're master tinkerers, Patrick.
Yeah. What's this part?
I think you can validate that.
Oh, yeah.
It's the part that does what it's supposed to do when you pull the trigger. Go shoot your gun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bill sits so still, I can't tell if he's buffering, and I just watch to see if his eyes blink.
I'll tell you what, I hunt a lot of rats, and if you get used to that, you learn to stay remarkably still, because they really have terrible vision, but they respond quickly to motion. So if you can stay perfectly still, they will walk right past you.
Wow. And, they're like T-Rex. They're sights based on motion.
Crazy. Yeah,
absolutely.
You reminded me, Bill, I learned something about iguanas last week that I wanted to share with the audience. And you'll see me in the video like this all the time. And they if you wear sunglasses, you know, they're looking at you, you know, like up above the grass and stuff. And as long as you got your sunglasses on, you're good. But as soon as you do this, once they can see your eyes, there's something that triggers their evolutionary response, and they can see well, 50, 60 yards. As soon as they see your eyes, they get all freaky and paranoid, and they're ready to bolt. And Jessica taught me that earlier on. You know, you leave your sunglasses on like as long as possible. But there's something about when they see your eyeballs, man, they get really
Your eyes are forward facing. You're a predator, right? So they see.
I guess.
I wonder how those glasses with the like googly eyes on the springs, how they would work. If that would really
probably confuse the hell out of them.
Either that, or you'll get asked to leave whatever your permission you're on.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm probably going to get asked to leave anyway.
There were some people at the park like, "What in the heck?" Because you know we're walking around with what looked like AK-47s and AR-15s, like plug-in lizards. You know, you can buy these things in a pet store. And some of these people were just like, you know, there's people fishing around there, and they're just like, "What in the heck are you guys doing?" And you'd have to stop occasionally and explain to people that, you know, we're there on behalf of the county and a park, and this is the problem, and you know, we're gonna solve the problem and save the owls.
If I tried to do that in California, I would probably get a bunch of hippies and surrounding me trying to do a prayer, you know, circle or something.
Save the rats.
Save the rats.
Save the rats.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Save the rats.
So I've got a rat story, Bill. My family and I went, this is a ways back, maybe 7 or 8 years ago. We went to San Francisco. My youngest boy, he was about 10 or 12 at the time. He took a friend and my wife, and we went to San Francisco, and you know, the kids wanted to go to Chinatown. Okay. So we went to Chinatown and, you know, had fun there walking around and, you know, just buying stuff that they have in the store. And, you know, the kids are just having a blast. You know, $20 bought a basket full of stuff for them, you know. So then they wanted to go to Japanese town, which wasn't, if I remember correctly, it wasn't too far away. So we thought, we'll just walk over there, right? So we went to Japanese town, and it wasn't as big or as many shops and stuff as it was in Chinatown. And I really like San Francisco, to be honest. I love the food, I love the ocean there and the museums and all the rest. I really enjoy myself.
Especially
the food, you know. Skomas is a great place to go eat. I just love it. So anyway, we just kind of left Japanese town. We're walking down the sidewalk, and we come to a light, and we're going to stop at the light to wait for it to change to cross the crosswalk. And I look down, and there's a rat the size of
a chihuahua?
A cat. I mean, I've never seen a rat so big before, okay? And he was alive, and people were just walking around paying him no mind, and this rat was there waiting for the light with the rest of us to cross the street. Yeah, I kid you not, man. No one raised an eyebrow or cared.
And I'm probably thinking, just used to them there.
I mean, it was incredible. This rat just waiting there, get across the street with the rest of you.
Had nothing to fear because nobody ever minded it.
Nobody kicked him or nothing. I mean, he was huge. I'd be afraid he would, you know, take my toe off or something.
Wow. Like one of those wombats from.
He was size of a nutria. Amazon. You know, a nutria is big, right? You've seen it.
A nutria, like nutria big.
I mean, his tail was massive. I mean, his tail was like that big around at the base.
Gross, man. You got to wonder what they're eating there to get that big. Maybe it was somebody's pet or somebody
was petting him up to
put him on the dinner table or something.
I think he had eaten some poison, maybe. I mean, because he was a little out of sorts. He was above ground and maybe he was high as a kite or something. He didn't know where.
That cyanide hadn't kicked in yet.
Yeah. I mean, fully. Wow. Something else.
Gross.
We'll call him George.
George.
What's up, George?
It was an experience.
That's crazy. Well,
you guys got any more questions on the SK-19? I feel like I've become one with this thing over the last 2 weeks. I've got so much I've learned to share, and I feel like we're just barely scratching the surface.
The only question I have is, when is one going to come to Ohio? That's my question. Well, other than that, I think we've dug into it really, really well. I'm excited.
I'm sure there's people in Ohio right now that have loads of them.
Maybe.
I don't think that's what he meant.
That's not what I meant.
I know that.
I think Patrick was getting political on you, Robert.
Very political. Like, no, I'm all good.
Each company has its own specialty, and each company has to survive and grow in its own way.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
So
yeah, that's a great way to put that. Everyone's got a family to take care of.
And we've got Dennis Baker. Didn't he in Ohio? And Baker in Ohio.
He's down
give
in.
Give him a call. He'll sell you. Give Dennis a call. He'll sell you one. No problem.
I will see him the 4th of June, and so will Bill, because we have a table at the Midwestern Air Gun Show here in Grove City is where it's at. Grove City, Ohio. So
okay,
yeah.
Is there another air gun show that was fairly recent? I mean, that I was at Dennis Baker's place 2 months ago, I think it was, and they were kind of him and Chad Kettner were kind of getting ready to.
Show. This is the biggest one on this side of the United States, short of Texas.
Okay, I know Chad bought a bunch of collectible stuff off of us here recently that he thought he could go take to the show and, you know, maybe find some interested parties there.
Yeah.
I know Larry's been with the PAD van and he says it's a real nice event. I've never been, I would like to go, but it's, if it's always on that 4th of July time, we're usually up at a summer home playing golf or something, you know, taking advantage of that. But, I'd like to go. I understand it's successful and I've heard nothing but really good feedback from it.
I think this is the 4th or 5th year. Last year was the first year that the Air Gun Geeks were there. And even with COVID, it was packed. And this year, they got a lot of people coming. And we were all told, get ready. And hotels are sold out. So that's always a good thing.
So question for you, Patrick. Is it a show that is predominantly guys bringing their own personal goods to sell and talk and, you know, kind of have like an air gun weekend, you know, or is it more corporate to where companies come and set up and sell, or is it somewhere in between the two?
It's a mixture.
Because the one in Placerville, was definitely more along the lines of end users coming and, you know, showing off their, at least that's the impression I got.
Yeah, you have a lot of old timers that have old school stuff from way back when, all the way up to the modern day state, Brocock, LCS, all the new stuff. I mean, you got Baker Air Guns is there. They're obviously the main people.
Target Forge will be there.
Target Forge.
Yeah, good for you.
Yep. But it's a lot of, you know, end users, if you would, air gunners. They bring their stuff. It's like I would call it like a gun show, a firearms gun show kind of situation. Right. You got a mixture of everything.
Bill, I've got a question for you. Whenever we've done a few in the early days, we did some gun shows, you know, Phoenix is famous for its gun shows. We've got some big ones, but we never really were able to get any kind of traction. Maybe we could now more so, but I always felt like, man, that's a lot of time and effort and money spent And it was always a negative cash flow deal for me. You know, I never left. I don't think I've ever been to a gun show where we left with more money than we spent. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you find those? Is it maybe a product? You know, with Target Forge, since you're mainly targets, do you turn enough to make it work?
I think what's unique about my product in that space, in that event, is that it's relatively inexpensive and people have that $20 in their wallet that's burning a hole and they want to come home with something cool from the show. And I, you know, this year at the Pacific Air Gun Expo, I had actually planned to launch Target Forge 2 years ago at that show, not because I thought it would leverage my brand at all, but because, you know, that's kind of where I formulated the idea, was being there the year before. And I was really absolutely blown away at the response that I got that Saturday at the Pacific Air Gun Expo. I actually tripled my money on that trip, just with the sales from the table. And, you know, what really blew me away, and if I'm honest here and I can bandstand for a minute, mm-hmm. on the Target Forge brand, when I put the display up of the T-poster, the unit that holds the clip that holds the conduit to the T-post that allows you to put a target anywhere really quick and really easy, that absolutely blew up. I mean, I sold so many of those at that show. And, you know, it's hard to get that image across to the customer online, right? I mean, they can see it. You can tell them what it does. But mm-hmm. when they come and they see it with their own eyes and they're like, holy crap, that would be so much fun to shoot. And I could dump pellets into that all day. That's where my hook happened. And I think I don't think you're going to be successful at a show like that bringing a bunch of $3,000 air rifles on the table. I just don't think that's not the market for that.
No.
That's what I was just thinking, Bill. You have the perfect, mm-hmm. perfect emotional response show knickknack where, you know, where everyone's going to want to take one home, you know, when they see it, because they can all relate to it, you know, how they use it. And but an air gun is like, it's like buying a $250,000 RV. You know, you go to a show to learn about it and become aware about it and go, holy shit, this is an air gun today. Then you mm-hmm. go home, then you research it.
Yeah.
Then you get on YouTube. You
watch YouTube for a few hours. Click, 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 click.
Yeah.
Click.
Learn all about it. And then you make that educated purchase. Absolutely. Because that air gets up awful thin, up around $1,500, $2,000, $2,500 bucks for an air gun.
Sure, mm-hmm. it does.
So they want to do their due diligence. You know,
it's not an emotional purchase, is it?
No, it's not an impulse purchase.
It's not an impulse buy. Where, you know, like you said, I think that's a good comment. A $20 target.
I will also add to that, Robert. I think that if you were to go to a show like that and you had a ton of really good swag that was Air Guns of Arizona, t-shirts, jackets, you know, stuff like branded items like that, mm-hmm. you could definitely clean house with that stuff. And again, it's right in that sweet spot. Mm-hmm. I'm going to burn a $20 bill at this table and get a t-shirt and hit the bricks. You know, that kind of stuff does move. And if you could see, if you had a crew that was mobile, that didn't cost.
Well, we do have a crew that's mobile, as you know, and we've got a.
Yeah.
But yeah. I think it's when it's July the 4th.
June 4th.
It's June 4th.
Correct.
Yeah, I think Larry is going to have the van at the Techstream, so you know there's no way you can be at two places at, mm-hmm. at one time.
Elon Musk will fix that for you soon enough.
Our hero, go Elon.
Go Elon.
Woo! He just needs to buy YouTube too, and then I'll be like a mosquito in a nudist colony.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Woo!
Yeah.
Well, did he kind of changing direction, did the sale of Twitter go through for him? I know he was Mm-hmm. I'd heard
yeah.
that.
Yeah, he owns it. Yeah. He's the big shot there.
He paid too much or something.
He's making cultural changes as we speak.
Yep. Well, it's about time. You know, it really yeah. is. It's about yeah. time that us gun lovers have a place to talk.
Yeah. That you know? Pendulum was due for a swing back the other way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Freedom of speech and the ability to exchange ideas freely without censorship. Yep. Has been a big part of what's made our country great in this direction. Sure. It's gone where, you know, people are trying to quiet, you know, the messages that are out there, mm-hmm. whether they're right or wrong or truthful or not. On both sides, it's just important that all that information be shared mm-hmm. so that people can make an informed decision for themselves.
Agree.
Agree. Yeah.
And
are we talking air guns and SK-19s so, here? So, I feel like we hopped on the wrong bunny trail, and my audience is going to be like, "What the hell are you guys talking about?"
So
I brought up the show question. It's I hope you are super successful.
Me too.
Going because it's a big, you know, that's a big trip for you. That's a long ways.
I was shocked he was coming out. So I get to pick him up. I get to take him back to the airport and spend time with him and breakfast and show him my end. And this will be the first time I meet Bill in person. He's been a staple of the Airgun Geeks podcast. We started January of last year. He came into our lives in March and has been a mentor, a friend, a shoulder to cry on at times because, you know, this isn't easy. We get a lot of good emails and we get some very mean ones. So
what would be your mean ones? Why would you get mean emails?
Like, why are you killing animals? Why are you creating these torture devices and promoting that? You know, I'll get something about the iguanas, you know, because I talk about the varmint business and they're like, why would you do that?
That's
you know,
that's just part of it. Patrick.
So
yeah, hey, for my audience that hasn't seen it. You before,
mm-hmm.
how can they find you, Patrick, if they want to listen to your Airgun Geeks podcast and stumble across you on YouTube? Where do they go?
So we are on every type of platform you can find a podcast. Primarily, we're on Amazon, we're on Spotify, we're on Apple Podcasts. You can even just go to airgungeeks.com. And you'll see the list, and it'll take it to whatever platform you normally use for podcasts. Mm-hmm. I am working on a website. I'm getting there. It's a lot of work. And then YouTube, I partnered like with you, Steve. I get to see your people. I've talked about doing video in the past. I'll be honest, guys. I just don't have time. And running around, and I also compete and getting the word out and whatnot. So you'll see Bill and I. He's my field reporter. We're going to meet at RMAC, and I'll probably see Steve there too. And then if I could swing it, because I do have a full-time job that I work 9 to 5, I'd love to go to EBR and experience because it's different people. But it's all about money and time right now. So
well, then why not just choose EBR?
Now, boys. Hey, Bill. We're gonna keep
that's
family
a good one.
Friendly. Hey yeah. Bill, if
Steve,
if
you
my
grab
audience,
one, I'll grab the other.
Yeah, there you go. Hey Bill, if my audience wants to find you, and you're new to them, where do they go to do that?
Well, the first place they should go is Target Forge on YouTube. Just put in Target Forge on YouTube, and you'll find my YouTube channel there, and give us a subscribe there while you're visiting, and also the business Target Forge is targetforge.net. And we love to make people to bring our products to people to let them have the most fun they can have with a pellet.
And what are your products, Bill?
We make reactive targets and also easy setup targets that don't weigh a ton. They don't take a lot of space in your vehicle. They break down really quick. They set up really quick. It basically is just really nice home and club target equipment for the consumer. And actually this Friday I'm going to receive a shipment that is a new product for Target mm-hmm. Forge, and it is range flags. So they're really nice, designed to be in the outdoor environment, range flags in 10-yard increments, so you can mark out your range and have range markers that are portable. They're cheap, And we think that's going to be a fun product too. But
and you're for, oh, sorry, Bill.
No, go ahead.
You're for powder burners and air guns alike.
No, all of our stuff is in the air gun range. I mean, some of our stuff reaches up into 22 long rifle velocities and energy levels. That's fine. But you know, that's a huge industry. The firearms target companies are really big and really have a lot of marketing money. I saw the niche in the air gun world because finding quality, and I emphasize quality air gun targets that are American made and durable in the environment is really a challenge. So I thought I could fill that space, and it's been a heck of a lot of fun.
I know a lot of people speak very highly of you and your products, Bill. Mm-hmm. So my audience, check them out. And I know y'all know Air Guns of Arizona. They were one of my very first sponsors 7 years ago. And
happy to be there for you, Eddie.
Thank you. And they've been an enabler for me for a long time with a lot of product and precision air gun distribution too. So thank you, Robert, for that. And
thank you for the invite. I appreciate the time that you've been able to let me babble on.
Yeah, this is cool. I like it because, you know, the audience gets to know you. And if you're hearing us on the Air Gun Geeks podcast for the first time, guys, I have two YouTube channels, AEAC Home, AEAC Vlog, all about air guns, reviews, factory tours on the world, shooting coverage as far as events around the world. And now we're going to get into some pesting and some hunting too. So the Air Gun Exploration and Advancement channel on YouTube, AEAC Vlog, Instagram Hooked on Air, Facebook Hooked on Air, and I have a website too, AEAConline.com, if you want to know what's in the bullpen and the syllabus. So that's all I've got, Patrick, Bill, Robert. You guys have anything else for me?
I just want to emphasize one more time that the Target Forge targets, we've beat them up. They're still working. I've got stuff that's out there. And if you want to help support the Air Gun Geeks podcast, you can use Super Geek 10 when ordering at Target Forge. Of course, check us out. I think we're going to have a special gift at the show if you see us. So I just wanted to say that. I want to thank everyone for their time. Robert, yourself, taking time out of your busy schedule. And of course, all of your listeners and subscribers, Bill and Steve. I'm very appreciative to be part of this group and this culture and this family. So thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. I appreciate you having me on.
Bill, it's good to see you again, Steve.
You too, Robert. Bill, good to see you. See you guys in a couple of weeks. And thanks again.
Take care. All right.
Bye.